Hey, group chat, I know y'all see my text.
There's tea to be spilled.
Each week, we're bringing you our unfiltered take on culture, news, dating, and our lives as Black millennial women. We're coming to y'all with the honesty and eye rolls that only a text chain with your girls can. This is Black Girls Texting with Chelsea, Glenn, and Sade.
Girl doing ish. I feel like I can't curse in front of you, Dr. Stewart. So our Black girl doing ish is Dr. Diane M. Stewart. She is the Samuel Candler Dobbs Professor of Religion and African American Studies at Emory University, specializing in African heritage, religious cultures in the Caribbean and the Americas, and womanist religious thought and praxis. Her research has been supported by the Fulbright Scholar Program, which is amazing, the Bill and Carol Fox Center for Humanistic Inquiry, and the American Academy of Religion. She is the author of Three Eyes for the Journey, African Dimensions of the Jamaican Religious Experience, Black Women, Black Love, America's War on African-American Marriage, and Obia, Orisha, and Religious Identity in Trinidad, Volume 2. And Orisha Africana Nations and the Power of Black Sacred Imagination. Her work has also been published in the Washington Post, Oprah Daily, and other outlets. Now, Dr. Stewart was born in Kingston, Jamaica, and raised in a nurturing Caribbean immigrant and African-American community in Hartford, Connecticut's North End. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm so excited.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure. Pleasure to be here.
It's funny, you and Chelsea were briefly talking about Colgate offline, and then I just realized you grew up in Hartford and I went to Trinity.
Oh my goodness. So many overlaps.
I know.
Well, I went to summer camp at Trinity from like 10 to 15.
Oh my gosh.
Very, very powerful experience. It was well curated and organized to really give so-called inner city youth a good summer experience. And I really valued and treasured it.
Oh, that's so good to hear. It's such a small, small world. Many connections. We're really excited to speak with you after learning more about you. Chelsea's family's Trinidadian. My family's Caribbean. My boyfriend's Jamaican. So we're just overlapping with the cultures and the connections today. We had heard about you and dug into this podcast on The Weeds. It was entitled Why the Marriage Rate is Falling Faster for Some. And we knew immediately we wanted to have you on the show because if you're listening and you're unsure about who that marriage rate is falling for, it is for Black women in America. So your first public-facing book titled Black Women, Black Love explores the structural forces that across four centuries have made coupling and marriage difficult, delayed, or impossible for millions of Black women in the United States and reveals how white supremacy has systemically broken the heart of Black America. So that's a mouthful and there's so much to say there. I'd love if you could expound on that for us.
I'd love to. In fact, that first part of what you read there is what I named. I felt that this needed to be named, Forbidden Black Love. That's how I define it. We are at the end of the tail end, and it's still continuing, of a four century experience of forbidden Black love. It begins on the African continent with the slave trade. Just imagine, we're never ever encouraged to imagine how our intimate lives are deeply affected by the slave trade and slavery. We think of rape, but we of women of African descent. That's about as far as we typically take it. We don't even think of the rape of boys and men, which also happened. But we think of rape of women and adolescent girls. But when we really think about it, just think about the disruption that the slave trade caused to marital homes, to families, to couples on the continent itself. And so for me, Forbidden Black Love begins there. And it continues in the Americas, and I'm particularly speaking of North America, continues in this North American experience till this very day. So that's how I define it. Literally, the systems and structures that make coupling and marriage difficult, delayed, or impossible for millions of Black people, particularly women. And so I came upon this topic and I felt that I needed to write about it because I couldn't find a book that addressed it. I couldn't find any one place I could go to truly talk about these issues from a structural and a systemic standpoint. We talk about love and marriage woes, and I enjoy it too. I love talking about it from the personal, the intimate side. It's fun. It's dramatic. It's cute. It's, you know, it's playful. It's flirtatious to think about all the different things you can do, strategies one can take to make love more exciting, more enduring, more. We do that. It is a very intimate, personal thing. We experience relationships interpersonally. But we have to think beyond that scope and understand that no matter how much we discuss this issue as a personal issue for Black women, we are never, ever going to get at the underlying factors, which are systemic and structural. So I'll just end this, you know, response by saying this. I identified four, there are probably many, but I saw themes across history that I kind of grouped under four major kind of pillars of forbidden Black love. So the first is the separation of Black marriages and families. And of course, I said that starts on the African continent. The second is racist, sexist jurisprudence, policies, and legal transactions. And by racist, sexist, that's a hyphenated word. We experience racism in our bodies as gendered women or gendered girls, and so do men and boys. So racist, sexist, to me, is it goes together, and it means that we're experiencing racism because of our gender in very distinct ways. And I can say a little bit more about that. But that's number two. Number three will not be a surprise, sexual and reproductive violence and control. And number four, which is related to number three, and when, you know, thinking about the slave trade and the slave period, is colorism and phenotypic stratification. So colorism is a form of phenotypic stratification, but we're so used to only talking about colorism. We don't often talk about other aspects of phenotypic stratification, the shapes of our faces, our lips, our nose, our
like featureism.
That's right. The textures of our hair, phenotypic features, believe it or not, is one of those pillars of forbidden Black love.
Wow.
Yeah.
Can we delve more into the second one? I feel like that one, I would like to learn more.
Absolutely. So what I'm really talking about here, and it's in many respects related to a nation whose ideas about marriage, about coupling, about family building, revolve around Euro-Western patriarchal ideas. And whose disregard for women of African descent emerges through all kinds of legislative practices, or whose focus on everything that the fungible Black female body could produce for the United States, for Western Empire, led to particular policies and particular legal transactions. I'll give you an example. So in the 17th century, in colonial Virginia, Black women's labor began to be tithed in the mid-17th century. Before that, men's labor, 16 and above, had been tithed, right? So people had to pay taxes at the end of the year as a result of their labor. It might have been in, who knows, bushels of corn or something like that, right? But they had to pay taxes. So all of a sudden, they realized that Black women's bodies, because most of them were enslaved, should be tithed, right? Pay taxes to the colony. If she was married, her husband was responsible for paying it. If she was not married, she was responsible. If she was owned by a slaveholder, that person was responsible. We see in the records that Black men are beginning to marry Irish indentured laborers because they don't have the money to be paying for these ties. They don't have the money to be responsible for this.
Oh.
We begin to see that kind of impact of a law like that. We see, for example, I see in the records, there's a really good one. This was a Virginia planter as well. William Getty was his name around 1816. In his will, it's fascinating. He says that, I'm going to see if I can even pull it up. He says, I bequeath to my wife, a husband and wife and slave couple, right? There's a woman and a man. And he says, upon her death, the man is to be sold, but the wife is to be, no, upon my death, the man is to be sold, but the wife stays with the property of my wife, right? The enslaved woman stays the property and all of her increase. That's what they build their empires on, their capitalist empires on, the Black woman's womb. So think about this. They're a couple together on the same property. But as soon as the slaveholder dies, her husband is able to go free. But because of her womb and what it means for their wealth building, she remains enslaved. That's what I mean by racist, sexist jurisprudence. She remains enslaved and all of her increase, and they are to be divided up. And he really lists out the grandchildren and who gets what and who gets what. Now, it doesn't mean that the husband would have necessarily been out of her reach, but that could have been possible. Many of these southern states created all kinds of laws that required freed or emancipated African descendants to leave the state by sundown the next day. Literally, they never wanted freed family members within the vicinity to put the idea of freedom in their enslaved relatives' heads. So it's possible that once he was freed, he might have had to leave the state forcefully. He might have had to because of laws. So that's what I mean. Particular kinds of laws that are generated because of Black women being women and being Black and often enslaved. So that's what I mean. And we see it come into full view with widows of civil rights veterans. And I'm so glad that I did write about welfare because I was torn about it. I knew I had to, but I thought everyone knows this story. When Black women are beginning to enter welfare programs in large numbers in 1950s and 60s, well, a number of people in your generation don't know that much about it, actually. So really, I'm realizing in teaching students that it really was a good thing to do. But when we look even before the period of the 1950s and we look at the end of the Civil War, Black women relative to white women, their petitions for Civil War benefits based on their deceased or disabled spouses who were Civil War veterans were often denied, and at much higher rates. They treated Black women suspiciously, like they were grifters. The U.S. government even produced a particular set of instructions, a manual for social workers who were going out to investigate petitions. And it even says at one point, if the spouse is claiming to be the mother of a set of children, observe the complexion of those children carefully. If the complexion does not match the mother, it's likely that these are not her actual children. So it's unbelievable the way Black women were treated, Black wives of Civil War veterans were treated. And that was really a dress rehearsal for what happened when Black women started entering welfare programs, federal and state sponsored welfare programs in the 1950s. So those are just some examples.
Yeah, that is intense. And it also makes a question pop up into my head because we've been talking about this idea of Black love. Do you think that it is the objective of the state specifically to damage Black love? And when I say Black love, I mean Black men and Black women together.
It's a great question. And I think a few people asked me about that early on because I call it a war. And so for me, I could say no, I could say yes. For me, it doesn't even matter. It doesn't matter. What matters is the outcome. What's the outcome? The outcome of state actions of callousness and abuse of people of African descent in this nation is the disruption of intimate relationships. Ultimately, doesn't matter to me. I can't say that I know the intentions of the state at every time in the period of history, and I don't even care. What I do care about is that the outcome of its actions, of its policy violence, of its callous ways of abusing and treating Black people has intimate consequences. It's not just, you know, whether people can eat or attend college or get healthcare. It also has to do with whether people can be coupled as adults and have companionship and meaningful lives as a result of those kinds of companionships. So honestly, Chelsea, doesn't matter to me if it's intentional or not. I know what the outcomes are, and we need to address them. We need to talk about them. If we don't address them at the level of civil rights, which is what I argue in the book, that forbidden Black love is America's hidden civil right issue. We won't. Black women can get in the gym, tighten up their butts, take the bass out of their voice, get the best weaves, whatever. Black women can do all of that, and one will get married. Literally, one. Like it. What we're doing personally is all great. I am not against self-help. I think we should all seek it and do the best to be our best selves, not just for potential partners, but for friends and family members, etc. No problem. But let's not fool ourselves into thinking that this is going to solve the problem. It's not.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Hey, group chat. Have you ever wondered what's in the products you use on a daily basis? Elle, like the letter, is a brand committed to providing you period care products inspired by nature, made without dyes, fragrances, and synthetic pesticides. Their pads have a breathable cotton top layer and plant-based core, and their tampons contain an organic cotton core. Not only can you feel good about Elle's ingredients, but also Elle's price. With tampons and pads that protect for under $5 a month, Elle believes access to period care is not only a fundamental right for everyone, but an opportunity for change as well. That's why Elle is on a mission to make exceptional period care accessible for all by providing funding each year to nonprofit community-based organizations around the world. And their focus on period care accessibility, menstrual health education, and employment opportunities. So, if you're looking for a brand that aligns with your values of giving back and using products inspired by nature, look no further than Elle. If you want to learn more about their mission or browse their full range of products, visit their website at thisiselle.com. And the next time you're in the period care aisle, look for Elle pads and tampons. Choose love, choose Elle, and tell them that Black Girls Texting sent you. Hey, group chat, it's Sade, and y'all know I love to shop Black, okay? There's a whole collection of Black-led products that fit into your daily lifestyle, and you can show Black founders some love so easily, not just during Black History Month, but all year long. There is power in every purchase, because every time we buy a Black-led brand, we make room for another Black-led brand. Black founders and the products they bring to the table are creating a whole new world of choices at Walmart. So go to walmart.com/blackandunlimited to discover all the amazing Black-owned brands you can add to your daily routine. Some of my personal favorites are the Do Hair Care. They get my twists out popping. Okay. The Lip Bar. They have a red lip that can go on any hue. And if you have not tried Partake cookies, they are so delicious. So I highly recommend you go on over to walmart.com/blackandunlimited and tell them that Black Girls Texting sent you.
And now we're back with more Black Girls Texting.
And I know that you spoke to some of your thoughts around solutions from like policy perspective. So I'd love if you can share, like, if there is a solution, what does that look like? Maybe from what the government can do, and then if there's something that you think we need to do societally.
Well, you know, in the book, I talk about three particular places to begin, which involves everybody, which involves people of African descent, which involves all Americans, which involves different entities and structures like religious organizations and institutions, the government, advertising, you know, agencies, and you name it. Everyone mm-hmm. can participate. And the three are addressing, halting, reversing this long trajectory, these four centuries long trajectory of inherited wealthlessness and poverty in Black communities. And that's something that shocked me. I did not expect to leave working on this book making such a recommendation. I really didn't. I did not think, I think as deeply enough about how profoundly a lack of wealth impacts whether Black people are marrying or not. But it clearly does. So that's one. The second is, and this is a hard one because I think the state needs this more than anything, but the state, the government would have to, at the federal and local levels, would have to commit itself to understanding that this perspective has been undermining Black women and Black families for centuries. Dismantling the patriarchal nuclear idealization, I should say, of the patriarchal nuclear family structure, marriage and family structure, that is harming us on more than one level. I argue, absolutely harming us on more than one level. And it works its way into government policies. One of the main reasons that the Moynihan Report was so harmful, it was racist, sexist, right? That racist hyphen sexist that I talk about. It was so sexist because of the patriarchal underpinnings of how marriage and family are normatively arranged in Euro-Western cultures, and particularly in the United States. And so I can say more about that, but that's number two, really addressing this idolization of the patriarchal nuclear family that has harmed Black folks for centuries. And then number three, the third one, is truly taking on how, in aggressive and expansive ways, colorism and phenotypic stratification. I mean, Black women who are fair-skinned are twice as likely to marry up to the age of 30. It gets a little better after 30, but slowly so. Twice as likely to marry than Black women who are dark complexion, and 17% more likely to marry than Black women who are medium complexion. This is a real issue in our communities. Colorism does impact marriage outcomes for Black women, and fair complexion Black women, ambiguous looking Black women, are often able to marry men at the same socioeconomic status that they have mm-hmm. at higher rates than dark complexion Black women. So those are three that I point out. And in the book, I actually talk about Dr. Derek Hamilton's, he's an economist at the New School. I talk about his baby bonds as an example to address, for example, the wealthlessness, inherited wealthlessness and poverty. Sometimes people think, oh, there's nothing we can do. It's too big. No, there are things we can do. There are many things we can do. And I use his program, which is getting more traction out there, and certain states are beginning to implement it, as one example, just one thing that can be done to begin to shape the lives of Black individuals and couples differently.
So I'm not aware of his program. What is his program? Mm-hmm. What is it doing?
What I love about the program, about Baby Bonds, he proposes, in many respects, someone could say, oh, this is like a reparations program, but it's not. You know, so he designed it in such a way that no one can just say that and dismiss it, even though I do talk about reparations as well, because I think that that needs to always be pursued. But he proposed that the United States government reform its tax laws and the way it, you know, collects taxes and fund it this way through tax dollars. So he proposed that every child upon birth in the United States gets an investment, a monetary investment from the U.S. government, like a trust that is set up for that child. And this is the catch. It's based on the wealth of the family. That is powerful. Mm. So a child who's born into a wealthy family, like a Kennedy descendant, might get $10. Whereas a child that is born to a family whose ancestors were enslaved in this country, or a Native American family who's been dislocated and marginalized on reservations, and whose family are making poverty, you know, salaries at the poverty level or slightly above or what have you, might get $20,000 at birth. And that money is invested and held for the child, and that they can then have access to as a young adult to either, you know, start a business, go to college, whatever it might be, buy a house, to give themselves, to launch them as young adults. And some places are really beginning to take it seriously. So that's just one. And there are a number of scholars, economists, social scientists who have been proposing different strategies and different programs and policies that our government can put into place. And Dr. Hamilton actually cites America's Bill of Economic Rights, which previous, you know, maybe some time ago, more than probably a century or half century ago now, presidents have adopted and have implemented. And he says it's time for us to look at that history again and take that seriously. This nation doesn't love Black people. That is the problem. That is part of the issue. If we were not Black, this issue would be solved. This nation does not love Black people, disregards Black people, and constantly reminds us that our enslavement was our fault because we came from brutal savages who had no concept of God, which is absolutely a myth and a mythology of the highest regard, and continually reminds us that we have no ambition, we're inferior, this is all our fault. We deserve nothing, no handout, no nothing, no reparations. Imagine, like, no one would take this for white Jewish Americans. No one would take this for, no one, they didn't take it for Japanese Americans. They got their reparations. Right. So Native American community got their reparations. So it's doable. People act like this is not doable. It's very doable. It's just the government has to decide that it loves Black people and that it really does want to turn this around. So that's just one example in terms of dealing with wealthlessness, trying to put a dent in wealthlessness and poverty.
And so I'm wondering now, we have like the maybe hopes and dreams of potentially seeing the government turn around, which I don't even know what that'll look like. And I don't know, I would hope and pray I'll see it in my lifetime, but I might not. Do you have a perspective on what we as individual people can do as Black women and men to kind of undo some of the damage that's been done? I know as you think about colorism, but a lot of that has also been like somewhat of an indoctrination because of the white supremacy.
Absolutely, which just pervades our culture. And I think it's such a tough question to answer in terms of what are specific solutions. Because we're not just grappling with those historical forces and structures that are just embedded, deeply embedded in our culture. Like, you know, I just pulled some numbers from the American Family Survey, which is like tens of thousands of data on American couples, families. And what I'm seeing is that women's salaries for interracial couples, from Black interracial, Asian interracial, white interracial, women's salaries tend to be right around 50,000. Literally across the board, the men's salaries are over 100,000 higher. So it's wealthier men who are marrying interracially, which I think is very, very interesting. You know, and I've always thought that I feel like this idolization of, I know it's always been in our culture, but this idolization of white women or women who are closest to white women phenotypically, I think really became deeply, deeply embedded in our consciousness with the rise of, I remember being 15 when music videos began on television. Seriously. Our culture, I feel like from that time on, it's just gone downhill. Like really, like we're dealing with contexts where young people don't even talk to each other. It's a text, it's an emoji. We're not even situating ourselves in contexts where we can truly build relationships in front of one another, face to face, because love is about connection. It's about knowledge. It's about trust and intimacy building, which includes vulnerability. And all of that cannot happen. Sorry, I know it's Black girls texting, and that's cute and that's great, but it can't all happen through texting. So we're in a time, we're in a time when, you know, just our coordinates, our compass for truly building and sustaining healthy, loving relationships across friendships and romantic partnerships is difficult. That alone is difficult. But I think a couple things. I think we have to tackle and address this issue with colorism. We have to. And we don't do it by not saying anything about it to our children. That doesn't work. Not saying anything about it means leaving our children to the wider society, to let the wider society tell them exactly what they need to think about skin shade and phenotypic characteristics. Colorism hurts everyone. I mean, think about what it does to even fair-skinned people or people with a loose curl texture. I am valuable because of that. I mean, how can that undermine their own internal character development as a result? How can that, I am more, you know, worth something because of just the shape of the curl in my hair? What is that? It's ridiculous. It's unbelievable that this is what we have inherited. So I think our Black institutions, I think advertisement industry, other industries, the sports industry, you name it. If people care about this, we can do, in the book, I talk about an influencer who talks about the corrective promotion of dark-skinned women. And I think we need that. I actually think we do need the corrective promotion of dark-skinned women and girls. But also, beyond that, the devaluing of physical features, as if somehow we know that that's important in how people, you know, become attracted to one another. And I get all of that, right? But the devaluing of physical features in what it takes to have a truly engaging and satisfying relationship across time. Because the initial attraction, the dopamine rush that we get from the physical is just one phase. It's not what carries relationships. And so I really do think that we need to work on that as a community. We need to work on what it means to love and to learn how to love and to learn how to build relationships. And I think we can do that probably better, not just by seeking information or advice from your fly-by-night, you know, relationship expert, but real experts. Oh. Like real, you know, credentialed people who have licenses, therapists, people who are actually credentialed to help people, guide people in these areas of their lives. And so I think that's important as well. Knowing the difference between maybe something that could be entertaining and something that can truly be therapeutic and liberating, in terms of, how we build better futures with one another. But that also includes becoming more of a reading community. We're generally not a reading community, particularly Black men. We just aren't. I keep telling people, like, for me, a starting point, a phenomenal starting point for our community is Bell Hooks's book, The Will to Change. It's really written with Black men in mind, but it's for all of us. And it's such, she wrote it in such a way that it's, anybody can enter that conversation. There's no jargon there. It's such a great book. But I wonder if more than 1,000 Black men have read it in this country. If even.
I thought you were going to say All About Love. And then you were like, I was like, oh.
Oh, that's a great one. And I've used it. I use it in my Black Love course. But The Will to Change is
The Will to Change. Fabulous. Okay. Okay, we'll give that for Christmas for all the men in our lives.
Oh, yes.
I have a question because I'm not totally clear on where you stand on this. We have had relationship experts and coaches on our show. And one of the things that they do say, they touch on colorism and they talk about how Black women need to open up their dating pool and open up their dating options and actually look outside of Black men. What is your stance on that? Do you think that that is a solution?
No, I don't think it's a solution, but I think it's fine. Yeah, that's exactly my stance. Is it a stance? Is it a solution to forbidden Black love? No, it never will be.
But should
Black women do that? If that's what they want, go for it. Like, if that's what you want, if you feel like that's important to you, yeah, go for it. I feel like love is so hard to secure, period. I am not trying to police anybody's relationships. What I am trying to say is that it is not just accidental that millions of Black women want to marry Black men and have no options to do so. We gave all this attention in this country in the 1960s to Loving v. Virginia. Black men and Black women, miscegenation, right? Outlawed. I mean, it's just so crazy when you think of racialist thinking. There are no races, ultimately. Right? Like, this is mixing of blood. What are you talking about? There's human blood, period. Right? It's so stupid when you think about it. So that law, those laws needed to be ruled unconstitutional. I'm in favor of that. That's great. But we haven't looked at the fact that while all of that is going on, for all intents and purposes, Black love has been forbidden in this country.
Right.
For different reasons, and we're not giving attention to it. So what I say to that, to the whole issue of date interracially, is that that's not a solution. That doesn't help us solve the problem of disappearing Black men. How does that do that? So it's never a solution. It might be a personal option for an individual Black woman, but it's never a solution to the problem of what I call forbidden Black love. Absolutely not a solution.
And do you think specifically, sorry, Shadi, do you think specifically Black people pairing up is like needed, necessary for the Black community to progress as a whole? Is that like the argument? Like, why is it so important?
Well, first of all, most people do marry people from their same cultural and racial group. That's just what most people do. So what I'm just doing is saying if Black women want to marry Black men, there's something unusual about that. There's something wrong with that. That's like normal. That's what most people in the world do because they tend to be around those people. And some people want to do it, especially in this racist society, because they don't want to handle all of what comes with being in an interracial relationship, right? There might be other reasons. They do want to be a symbol for the race. They do, you know what I mean? To show that Black love is possible and can. So there are all those other reasons. Some Black women don't want to marry interracially because for them, there's a kind of psychosocial memory of the abuse of Black women. They are also worried about being, in fact, I talk about this in the book, how this can happen. They're also worried about being, exoticized and things like that. So there are reasons. And so what I don't want people to do is think there's something wrong with defending that Black women should be able to marry Black men if they want to. Like, that's
what we had someone come on the show and call it toxic loyalty.
Well, see, I know all about that. I know. Are you talking about divestment, the divestment movement? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to take, I'm actually writing a Black Love 2 now. I'm writing a follow-up. My audience okay. is more. And that's one of the major issues I'm going to take on in the book. Yeah, it, we need to address it. I think there are aspects of the divestment movement, particularly some of the critiques that they make about long suffering, sexism and patriarchy, misogynoir in our own communities. All of that is valid beyond belief. Some of them talk about it as struggle love and all of that. The problem that I have with the divestment movement is there's no structural analysis. And what it does, again, this is me going back to my argument about how patriarchy can be so harmful. These patriarchal, and really, let me even say 19th century Victorian ideas about the ideal womanhood and ideal manhood. What it does, oftentimes, what I find in those discussions, they idealize non-Black men, usually white. Even the white man is the invisible default man in these conversations. Upper class men, hypergamy is, you know, is valued and is, they focus on it. And this is how you catch an upper class. And that's great. You know, that's fine. That's fine if that's what people want to do. But he's described and thought of as some sort of panacea answer to all of these struggle issues you have with your Black man. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, if you read my book carefully, you can never say that I'm asking Black women to be abused or stay in abusive relationships with any man. I would never do that, ever do that. And I'm very, very clear. But what I resent, though, is assuming that if you're with a Black man, you're only up, you know, you're only setting yourself up for struggle and abuse. Why? Why would any, my mother certainly hasn't experienced that. Why would anybody, you know, just assume that? That is a problem, right? So, and one of the things that I'm clear about in terms of my focus, yes, I talk about marriage, but I also talk about companionship and relationships, and not just the numbers of how many Black women are getting married, but also what is the condition of the relationship? That matters, right? Mm-hmm. I have a whole section where I talk about toxic patriarchy and what that does to our relationships. But the answer is not divestment. And I can't pretend that I don't have three brothers that I love that I know are not toxically masculine. None of them is toxically masculine. Right? So I can't, like, I don't get it. Don't you have brothers, nephews? Like, how do you decide that Black men are hopelessly irredeemable? Mm-hmm. How do you make that decision? It sounds very much like racist, sexist, in this case, you know, what misandry noir, if I can, arguments, which are incredibly dangerous. And so yeah. That's my concern. I don't, some of them have even critiqued the way the church reinforces, and I would just say religious institution broadly, but for many people of African descent, we are often talking about experiences with Christian institutions, reinforce, you know, this struggle that Black wives struggle with husbands who are not treating them right or not. No, I'm the first one to tell you, go, get out. I would be the first one. And so what I don't like is the seesaw. I don't like the going from, you know, one extreme. Either you're like under the thumb of some toxically masculine Black man who's either beating you up physically or psychologically, right? And that, and emotionally and mentally. Or you're with this, you know, white steed who has come to rescue and put you on a pedestal. That's what I don't like, are the extremes. You know, yes, I don't want to minimize the fact that a number of women in the divestment movement and many women who haven't even gotten there yet have been in very harmful, dangerous, hurtful relationships, traumatic. But what I don't want to do is universalize such experiences as always being attached to Black men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And earlier you spoke about how almost the state had certain laws in place, or, you know, there were systematic reasons. Now it almost feels like the media is a part of this. Like, even how you describe this, like, evil black man that beats his wife. Sorry, Tyler Perry, but it's like every film is that is the plot. And then you have the manosphere, these men with podcasts. I mean, I know we have a podcast, but we don't bash black men. And you have these guys with podcasts and they just bash black women. And it's just like, we're almost doing the work.
Absolutely. For them. That's what I fear the most. But mm-hmm. I have a theory, and I'll put it out there. I've said it in a couple of places. Like, Wait for the book.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Toyota is doing big things helping grassroots community organizations across the country with its Nudge campaign. The Nudge campaign reflects Toyota's commitment to supporting and furthering the success of those who need it most. A few months ago, Toyota debuted the After the Nudge podcast. The podcast is a 7-episode limited series hosted by acclaimed journalist Soledad O'Brien and former NBA All-Star J.R. Smith. It features conversations with community organizations that Toyota nudged via $10,000 microgrants. We get to find out what happens after the nudge. On the After the Nudge podcast, you'll hear from founders and leaders like Paulana Lamonier from Black People Will Swim, Dr. Khalid El Hakim from the Black History 101 Mobile Museum, Demetrius Harris from Fly Compton Foundation, and others. Learn how a simple nudge from Toyota helped boost their momentum, amplify their movements, and or propel them to greater heights. Look for the Toyota After the Nudge podcast on toyota.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, group chat, it's me, Sade. Are you all tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card and tell them Black Girls Texting sent you.
You'll know it's real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee, and you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, sneakers and streetwear so fresh, every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to the thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
And now we're back with more Black Girls Texting.
This is tough. This is the hardest thing. And believe it or not, like, I really went off my topic, as you know, Glenn knows that because you all kind of looked up what I do. This black marriage stuff is new for me, right? Like, I've been teaching the Black Love course since 2004, but I had like a 12-year gap where I didn't teach a class. I didn't resurrect it till 2016. And love and marriage was just, it's just a small unit in the class. It's not, the class is about love and so many different issues. And so I really went outside of my zone, but there are a couple places in the book where I really could talk as a scholar of religion. And that was after, in chapter 2, when I talk about the socialization, what happened to the freed men and women in terms of how the government and volunteer societies and religious institutions went down south to save them and to prepare them for citizenship. Part of that education, part of what they received through the Freedmen's Bureau, through missionary societies, white and some black educators, liberal educators that were coming south, part of what they received was an education that said, Black man, you are the patriarch. You're responsible for your wife, all your children, everything. This is your sole responsibility for your household. And Black woman, you are the helpmate. And what I've concluded, I have my niece to thank for this. She insisted that I go on Clubhouse. I've done a bit.
Oh,
Oh, yeah. I've done a bit of, you know, conversations on Clubhouse. There are a couple houses that I visit regularly. I even have my own, like, rooms, but I haven't been using them in any regular way. But I am convinced that we're very clear. And I agree with the Afro-pessimist here. I don't know if you've heard about Afro-pessimist discourse, but it's a discourse that really has entered into popular culture and popular popular venues as well. It's not just academic, but it's high meta theory, but it's a discourse that really examines how anti-Blackness is the infrastructure of the modern world. And that that Blacks have a kind of unique form of suffering. It's a gratuitous suffering that there is no recompense for. There is no way to actually address the suffering of Blacks ultimately. You know, with Native Americans, you can give them back their land. White feminists, radical feminism, you can dismantle the patriarchal family. But what is the answer to the Black? What is the answer? What is the answer? And they show how historically the construction of racial Blackness and the epidermalization of it onto skins, onto persons, onto bodies, was exactly what was needed to design the modern world. And our suffering as a result of that is too endemic to it. But what I really want to raise here is that I think, and Afro-pessimists even say this as well, I think that our people have known for a long time that our race would never qualify us for humanity / citizenship. Because what they argue is that Blacks have no access to the human, ultimately. That, and by the human, what they mean is the liberal human subject that is deserving of rights, that is deserving of citizenship privileges. Ultimately, we have none. No access to it. And so what I've become more and more clear about, listening to conversations and participating in Clubhouse and reading things online, is that we're really clear that our race disqualifies us. You know, race, whatever that means, disqualifies us from humanity and citizenship. But we're really, really counting on the fact that our gender can qualify us. That's what we count on. Being the appropriate ideal man that this white normative Western society has said, being the appropriate ideal woman. I'm going to talk about that in Black Love too. I'm going to lay that out. And I tell you, so when I talk in chapter 2 in my book about how these, you know, volunteer organizations, the Freedmen's Bureau, socialize freed women and men into that kind of thinking, patriarchal thinking about family, about relationships between men and women, about masculinity and femininity, it was a really low point for us. Very low point. It's sad. It's really sad because that has harmed us in so many ways. And then in chapter 5, I bring back out my kind of religion stuff again, my religion expertise, looking at the Bible and Christianity and how certain passages have been interpreted about wives and husbands and their duties and roles to one another. I kind of begin to deconstruct some of that. So I really want to take that on in this next volume. And really address this underlying anxiety that I believe we have, and we're hanging it all on our gender. This is what truly qualifies us for humanity. When I can be that delicate feminine flower, when he can be my masculine savior and protector and head, that's when we're human. That's when we're citizens. That's when we get all the rights that we deserve.
And I feel like a lot of what you're saying, you said so many things. The things that stuck out to me the most is like, what is our just due? What does that look like? I feel like like you said, it doesn't exist because there could be monetary compensation in some ways, but like, how do you undo the impacts that now affect us, like socially, how we are thinking about relationships, how we're thinking about parent-child relationships? Like there really isn't a way to undo that. It just like we have to kind of be given the space to unlearn and work through that. And I think there are a lot of conversations about that. I feel like the buzzword is decolonize your mind, decolonize your whatever. But something I find really interesting in the conversation around coupling, specifically with Black couples, is this ideal that Black men will not be able to provide for the Black woman the way she, quote unquote, deserves to be provided for.
Why does he have to do that? Why does he have to provide for the Black woman? Why? Why? Like, I don't get it. And that's the furthest thing from our African heritage. African women provided for their families, worked, did all these kinds of things. There was no, like, you're in the house, I'm outside. What is that? Like, seriously, what is that?
Well,
why
I know
to provide for the woman? I really want to understand that. Why couples can't get together and create a plan that works for them, that includes women participating in what it means to build a household. And even if sometimes what that turns into, especially if she's going to be having children or what have you, is that it looks like more of a traditional household. That's okay too. But when it's fixed that you as man must do this because you are man, and I as woman must do this because I am woman, I think that that has truly sunk us. That is harming us.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned Clubhouse, because I'm on there, so we're gonna have to become Clubhouse
friends.
She's
still there.
Yes, please.
But I'm mostly in the audience listening, and the conversations that have been coming up for, what is it now, 4 years maybe, is relationships. Everyone wants to talk about relationships and the structure of the relationships and this idea of soft life, which from my understanding was kind of coined by Nigerian women, like, who were taken care of. And because I guess in that culture, it's a lot of men that are very like, I'm going to provide.
Sure. All and of everyone. Victorian, Christian and Islamic, colonial. Yeah. Indoctrination. Yeah. Sure. That's exactly where they are.
And
come 4 years, Dr. Stewart.
Yeah.
Four years later. That's
how it was before, but yeah.
Right. They've adopted it. So I wonder, because you did talk about the nuclear family, and if I'm understanding correctly, how that's kind of like Eurocentric a bit.
Absolutely.
Okay.
There was no concept of household in African traditional life. I mean, the household is one set off unit. No. And in fact, those African family forms, I talk about this in the book as well in chapter 5, have been one of the major resources that I think African descendants have had to survive this experience in the West. I mean, if you can even look at Latinx cultures. I mean, the abuelita is downstairs or uncle is upstairs. And, and studies show that they are more resilient oftentimes than Blacks because of those family structures. Mm. And in fact, that is something that we see. When and where we see those different family structures and forms operative in our culture, it tends to be more among the working class and poor. I think we become even more isolated into nuclear household arrangements the more money we make. Actually, I don't know how it works in the very upper class. I always wonder if Black, I mean, like millionaire class, if they also are very extended family oriented, something I've always been curious about. But by and large, yeah, I think there's something to be said about that. I mean, this kind of isolation where it's now you and me against the world, and we got to figure this out by ourselves, rather than have a wider family network to help us navigate life. It takes a village to raise a child or children. That's what I'm talking about. Like, and those family forms were pathologized in the Moynihan Report. And interestingly enough, I talk about this in the book, slavery, in this kind of ironic way, helped to reinforce some of those family forms, like the matrifocal unit, because of the disruption of family life, especially after the closing of the American slave trade, which really took effect in January 1808. Granted, the domestic slave trade was already pretty strong, but it boomed beyond what anyone could have imagined. We're talking about close to a million families disrupted, going south and going southeast as a result of the domestic slave trade. And so, you know, the matrifocal unit becomes, during slavery, the most important unit, the mother-child unit. And that has been so central historically in African family forms. It's not the only thing going on in family life, but it is an important aspect of family. So the Western notion of marriage is a notion that emerges out of property. You know, the reason you even need to know gender so early is because you need to know who is a boy and who is a girl so that you can decide who is property and who's inheriting it. You know, the girls are the property and the boys are inheriting it. Many African names are not even gendered. African languages, for the most part, don't even have gendered pronouns. All this stuff that they're bringing in, non-gendered, that was already part of African consciousness. There's an African feminist scholar, Yawunke Oyewumi, who does work on her Oyo Yoruba culture. And she argues that gender is a Western construct that was imposed on my culture. How about Nigeria? Imposed. Our societies are organized by seniority, not gender, is what she argues. There is so much that we don't know about that historical heritage. And it's so weird because Africans end up going through this colonial moment and they become more colonized than the colonizers.
Right.
And then they think this is traditional to them. You know, it's just unbelievable what is locked away in African cultures on this issue of gender, patriarchy, family formation. There is so much more that we could unearth and talk about. We had a moment after slavery to redefine ourselves, but we just kind of didn't. And now, again, all we see is people doubling down on that because that's the hope for our humanity, I believe. That's where our hope for our humanity lies. This is how I know myself to be a normative person, because I am really a woman. I am really a man. And I just wonder, can't we be more flexible about how we define manhood? What does it mean, Chelsea and Sade, when Black families, a Black couple, is following that, you know, that typical, you know, stereotypic family norm of you're supposed to provide and I'm the helper, and if anything my salary is just, you know, inconsequential, or maybe I don't work at all? And what happens when that can't be held up? We know that many Black families are egalitarian by necessity. Like, what happens if that's the model we're holding up in our heads, but the man cannot do that by himself, which many white families can't even do that by themselves. The men can't do that by themselves. What does that mean? And what else is being calculated in that relationship between husband and wife in terms of the husband providing the money? Money is power. What does that mean in terms of independence, in terms of authority, in terms of what does it mean in terms of people's likes and dislikes and skills? What if he's just a better cook than she is, or he's just, you know, it's all of that. Like, I don't want to police or tell people what they should do, but what I'm asking us to do is to question why masculinity must be tied to these roles and why femininity must be tied to these roles in fixed fashion. Why? Why is all, why not the flexibility? Because that flexibility, I believe, will free us to have better, more enduring, and more frequent relationships, meaning marrying and coupling even more frequently. Because if everyone's waiting for a high status man, whatever that means, keep waiting.
And it's all interwoven, right? Because then it's like, as you earn more as a Black woman, quote unquote, your pool becomes smaller, because some women feel as though they don't necessarily want to be with the man who makes less than her, or some men feel that they might be uncomfortable being with a woman who makes more. So then it just snowballs.
That's patriarchy. One of my students said last semester in the Black Love course, Dr. Stewart, I want a husband who makes more money than I do, not because I care, but because I know he will care. And I was like, that is so real. That's what I mean by patriarchy messing us up. That's what I mean. We don't have the freedom to understand the diversity and the dynamism of human beings, no matter how they're defining. in terms of gender. And that's what patriarchy truly limits. I find it, you know, ultimately some people would say, well, that's for you. You know, I want to do what I want to do. And that's fine. You can do what right. you want to do. I'm thinking broadly for our people as a whole. I'm thinking on the whole, what are barriers to healthy, enduring marriage? We have studies that show that egalitarian relationships, like the non-traditional patriarchal relationships, report higher levels of love. And I can see why. You know, higher levels of feeling loved and feeling like you're in a loving relationship. And I can see why.
Well, I would love for more people to have access to that report study, because I feel like the pushback that I always get in these conversations is, which I'm not trying to say, but is, well, why do Black women have to settle for less? Like, don't they deserve the soft life? Don't they deserve to be taken care of? Don't they deserve? And it's like, it's kind of a hard argument to have, because I understand it. We've all been taught, you know, Disney Channel, the prince sweeps you off your feet and carries you off into La La Land. But like, that is an interesting study, that higher reports of love have been in those other sorts of relationships. So
egalitarian relationships. Well, the other thing to think of, like, are those women happy in those relationships where they're being kept and the men are paid? Maybe they are. Are they? I mean, that's interesting. It would be interesting to know if they are. But also, where are these men going to come from? Like, where are they going to come from, even among other races? Like, really, where are they going to come from? Because what the studies are showing is the higher income that men have, they don't even want to marry in their same race. You know, they don't even want to. And a lot of them are not wanting to necessarily marry Black women either. So it's, first of all, where are all these men going to come from? And when has working been unfulfilling? Why is it always to the extreme? It's either it's a hard life or it's a soft life. Isn't there something in the middle? I don't understand. I'm not saying that. Now, let me be clear. I'm not making the argument that the woman with the MBA or the law degree or the PhD should be marrying the bus driver. That's not the argument that I'm making, because there's so many things that go into compatibility for relationships. And what you've been exposed to in your life does impact the relationship. It can impact other things like your salary, like the kind of job, but it impacts how you can talk to one another, whether you are able to communicate with one another. So I want to be clear. That's not the argument I'm making. Do you see my point? I'm not making this argument like Black women with these advanced degrees, go look for your working class brother. That's not the argument I'm making. I know I wouldn't be doing that. I'm just going to be honest with you. Personally, I wouldn't be doing that, because I know enough to know that I have to be able to communicate with the person. Now, someone like Sidney Poitier is a very, I mean, he's passed now, right? Didn't he pass away? He's a very, he feels like, you know, eternal. You know, he's a very good example. I mean, I think he had such a low level of education. I can't remember if it was like fifth grade, but he used to read like newspapers across, maybe over time he might have sought out but early in his career he used to read newspapers from around the world. I mean, you would never think that Sidney Poitier was not an educated man. He was an autodidact, there's no doubt about it. But most bus drivers are not going to be that. Mm-hmm. Right? And I am in no way trying to tell Black women, go and, you know, be with a bus driver if you have an MBA. I am not doing that. I'm not judging it if that's what someone chooses to do, but that's not what I'm recommending. But what I'm saying is, especially if you plan on having children, if you have an MBA and you're with someone else who has an MBA, who's a Black man, for example, say you as a Black woman, and you both come from families where you have no wealth, given the kinds of goals you're probably going to want to achieve, given the kind of lifestyle you need to have as a professional, it's probably going to be unlikely that you won't have to work, right? Or maybe not. It might depend on what he's doing. But if there's no wealth built up in the family, there are a lot of people in that middle or even upper middle class range where both people working might be necessary for the goals of the family. And I'm asking, what's wrong with that? I mean, mm-hmm. certainly if you're having children and you decide I'm not going to work for 5 years and you have that luxury or that, great. Even if you decide I'm not going to work at all, and this is the way it's going to be because I want to stay home and raise the children. I want to be a force, and I, the woman, want to do that. That's great. But can it not be because you, the woman, you must do that? Can it not be because you're the man? Can it just be, this is the arrangement we made for our family because mm-hmm. this works for us? Because what comes along with those ideal types for wives and husbands is a hierarchy related to power and related to, you know, what's understood to be natural characteristics. I find that dangerous for the most part.
I agree. But here, listening to you speak, I'm also having like other thoughts pop up in my brain. One of which is, okay, if there are a lot of Black men in jail, there are a lot of Black men who don't want Black women for whatever reason. What about the case for polygamy? Multiple women with a man.
So let me be clear. When you say polygamy, do you mean official marriage, marital arrangements, even if it's in the heads of the people themselves, because polygamy is not really
illegal.
Yeah, it's illegal. So you're saying people have said, we are married based mm-hmm. on our, they've done their own rights or whatever it is. They've done something to be clear, not just we're boyfriend and girlfriend, but we're in this polygamous relationship. Not that, right?
A situation where it's a man, multiple women, but we're in a household together. We're raising our children together. Finances are being split, structured that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's a marriage. And they're considering themselves to be married to one another permanently in a permanent relationship. I'm not judging it. Personally, I'm not. They're varied forms of marriage. And what I don't like is when people call cheating polygamy. That irritates me.
Yes.
Polygamy is a marriage system just like monogamy. So if you're talking about something where everyone has committed to living this way and doing this, I'm not going to judge it. You know, I'm certainly not going to judge it. I'm not promoting it either. That's the thing. I'm not promoting it. It's not what I'm promoting, but I'm certainly not going to judge it. And let's face it, those arrangements are happening. I think I even cite it in fact, I had learned about, but it turned out that one of the persons got very, very sick and the arrangement didn't work out in the end. Something happened where they had to leave. But I have heard of, and these were all first gen African, very like middle, upper middle class folks, so, you know, young professionals, like that two couples got together and purchased a home together, like a large home to raise their children in a village environment, literally. But they were monogamous couples, but living together in one home. So I've even heard of that. And it worked out really well. One of the spouses of one of the couples got very, very ill, I found out. And so I wanted to write about it in my book. It was a former colleague who told me about it. If one of them was actually a former Emory student. So I was curious. I wanted to learn more and to, you know, so I thought that was interesting as an arrangement as well. I mean, I'm certainly not going to judge folks who have made a polygamous arrangement. Absolutely. Not everybody can afford monogamy. Not all Black folks can afford monogamy. I'm not going to judge it, but I'm personally not also advocating it. It's just not my thing. It's just not what I'm advocating. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's so many layers to all of this because there's a side of relationships that I think focuses on like love, intimacy, some of those core values that those tug at your heartstring values. And then there is a side that is just straight up an exchange of like dollars and cents.
Mm-hmm. Which actually leads me to another question, because I was also thinking about like matchmakers, and there's this show Indian Matchmaker that's like popular on Netflix. Do you have an opinion on that, on marriage being less about the love and we're so attracted to each other and more about the, we are two Black people. We know we want to be with Black people and we work like same similar kind of family, same kind of education. Mm-hmm. So let's pair up and like for the good of furthering our community, we're partnering.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I actually love it. I actually told my students in my first Black Love class that I wish somebody would matchmake me at that time. I was single at that time. I actually told them, oh my God, I'd die for that. That's exactly what I want. I love both. I love both. I think, and marriages in terms of the way the brain works for attachment and for attraction and then for long-term attachment, our brains take us through the biochemical, neurochemical changes in our brain, take us through a number of phases. And I think both are important. Both are important. So I think like the romantic love, the dopamine kind of stuff, that's important for attraction and the initial attraction and all of that. And it can be sustained throughout the course of a marriage if people work hard, I think. Sometimes some people, there's just some sort of compatibility that makes it easier for some couples. But I think people have to work at it, especially in the isolated, you know, household, non-village cultures that we have that leave individuals out there by themselves. Mm-hmm. In a culture that says, my marital partner, my spouse has to be the everything to me. You can't get everything anymore from your village, right? No, the spouse has to be every. Why? You've got friends to fill some things. You got your parents, your family members, your neighbors, your, you know, coworkers. Why does our spouse have to fulfill us in every single way? That already is tough. That already wears on a relationship. That's what the non-village organization of family life does. It's a burden. It's such a huge burden for couples to carry. And that's why so many couples can't endure that. So that alone is a problem. But I do think that I love romance. I love love. Like, I love it so much. It's great. It feels good. It's awesome. But we do in this culture put too much emphasis on that kind of love. There's the long-term love that has to do with things that those matchmakers often know about. It's all of those kinds of qualities and capabilities. And I think sometimes we assume that matchmade couples don't have romance.
Right.
I don't assume that. I mean, romance can develop in those situations, right? So I personally would like a mixture of both. It reminds me of when I was a student, as an undergrad, Colgate had these amazing study abroad programs. So my first study abroad program was in Nigeria. And I remember like you could go to a party. Yeah. I loved it. It was awesome. Changed my life. You could go to a party and you would not know who's boyfriend or girlfriend because they come to a party and they separate. The women would go with her friends. The man would go with his friends. They're not all on top of each other. They're not all, and you see it over the course of people's adult lives. There are women's social societies, women's organizations, men's societies. Men, it's amazing. Like how, you know, the kinds of kinship responsibilities and the relational commitments that are made as a result give women and men different ways to connect and have relationships that the marriage unit doesn't have to bear all of it. At the same time, sometimes it can be too much of that. And you lose that intimacy. You don't have, and that's why I always said, you know, this American way where you're just all up on one another and hand-holding, and it's a lot. It's a lot. Like, I always felt like, can I just get something right down the middle? Can I get some of what we do and some of what I see in like these African, particularly in my case, it was Nigerian context, because I think they both have something to teach us about what we need as human beings, right? Mm-hmm. And what I've learned from biological anthropologists and neurochemists is that the reason our brains are built the way they are, and the hormones that make up love, the hormones that that work in love and relationships is because we need to be able to bond and attach to one another as couples, evolutionarily speaking, for a long enough period to raise a child into adulthood pro-socially so that that child can now have children and raise their child. Our species just takes about like 16 to 20 years, like eight, you know, to kind of make that happen. Mm-hmm. And so our hormones work to make that happen, work to make us get attached to people, to focus in on that one person so that we can stay there and raise those children into adulthood so that they can continue the life cycle, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of things that I've learned even about the neurochemistry of the brain and love that makes me feel like we need a beautiful balance of the two.
Both.
And to understand that at certain points in the life of a relationship, especially the brain, the chemicals and how they operate in the brain can actually make the more match-made type of marriage feel more normative in every day. And then, you know, this culture feels like you have to be at the, you know, on this kind of romantic high all the time or something's grossly wrong. But there are things that couples can do to keep the romance going but we have to be active about it. We have to be invested in it. You know, to keep it going. So does that make sense? I want a both and. I don't want to. Yeah.
No, I love that. A both and.
A both and. Absolutely love that. And I absolutely love talking to you. I know there were other things we wanted to get into, and I feel like we're going to have you back.
Oh, I know. We didn't touch on religion.
I know. And like, we have to get into that. And I love how you were even talking about how there's elements of the more maybe Christian based, or is it Abrahamic based religions, and what that looks like in terms of relationships. So I'll be circling back so that we can schedule some more time. And then hopefully Glenn will be able to join us because this is so fascinating. And I just absolutely love the work that you're doing. Like, I feel like Chelsea feels this too in many ways. Like, people are always theorizing and talking, but you've done the research. So you can back up what you're saying. And I absolutely love that.
That's the only reason I did the book. It was a passion project for Black women, for Black people, because what people notice as they read that book, I am not bashing Black men. And maybe that's even a problem for some Black women. I'm really saying, look at what has happened to us as a people and how that's impacted the deepest places of our intimate lives. And how can we actually partner to do this better, to find a way to get the justice for our relationships that we deserve as Black people? So I've actually had a lot of Black men say they love the book as well and have learned a lot from it. So this means a lot to me. As I said, it's my passion project. I wrote it because there was no other book out there that particularly address the topic in this way, and I'm thrilled to know that women in your generation are even finding it helpful and worth engaging. So thank you.
100%. I'd love if you can share you know, where listeners can learn more about your work. I don't know if you share on your social media or more on your website, more about your book, just so they can keep in touch.
Yeah, my website, it has most information, and that's DianeMStewart.com. So it's DianeMStewart.com. Is that what it is? I hope it is. You know how you don't even remember anymore what you're, sometimes you can totally get sidetracked. It should be that, DianeMStewart.com. And then my Instagram, also I do a lot, I'll post a lot of things on love, I think it's Diane M. Stewart, PhD. Gosh, I should know. It's almost embarrassing that I don't know what this is.
No, you're good. I double checked. It is. Diane M. Stewart, PhD.
And Diane has two N's in it. And I also am on Twitter. I think it's just Diane M. Stewart, at Diane M. Stewart. And Facebook, I think it's at Diane M. Stewart. Might have a PhD as well. Isn't that sad? I can't remember.
No worries.
I'm not natural at this stuff.
And I have to find you on Clubhouse.
On Clubhouse. Did you find me?
No, is it just your name?
I don't even know. How would I figure it out?
I'll find you. I'll do some digging.
Okay. Isn't that, you know, I tell you, I'm so not a natural at this. When my book was coming out, my publisher said, get Twitter or revitalize Facebook, see what you know. And then my niece just like, you know, got me into, nope, you got to do Instagram too. So that's how I kind of slowly made my way around the rounds, but I'm not.
You're doing it. You're making it work.
I'm not a great user of these things. I try, but I'm not. I don't think I'm fabulous.
Well, you have to come back because we need to discuss the religious studies, especially Shade here hasn't told you, but she's not a Christian.
No.
Glenn told me. Wonderful. Hey, great. Awesome.
I'm so excited. I'm like, literally, as soon as we sign off, I'm going to be emailing you like, okay, when are we going to do part two? So yeah. I love this.
Yes. Clubhouse is at Diane M. Stewart.
Yes, at Diane M. Stewart.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Thank you so much, Dr. Stewart.
It's been my pleasure.
We really appreciate your time and we'll be back for more. This is just the beginning.
All right. Thank you both. I've enjoyed meeting you and talking with you. Such great questions.
Thank you.
Enjoyed the time. All right. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks again for listening to Black Girls Texting. Make sure to rate and review this podcast wherever you listen and subscribe so you never miss an episode. Oh, and don't forget to text every group chat you're in and tell them to check us out. Follow your girls at Black Girls Texting, and we'll see you next week. Bye.